Good afternoon. Good afternoon. So, I hope they have some sort of... Okay, so... Yes. Yep, okay. That microphone works, it's just maybe not as loud as it should be. Okay. So, last time, we started talking about processors from a very high level, and we gave this model of processors as this thing that does computation, but we need some other components to make our computer. So one of those components was memory. We need sort of a lot of storage. We learned that what we call a processor has a little bit of storage in what we called registers, but sort of the main storage is in something we called memory, which we decided would be organized as this array of bytes. And the processor needed to communicate with the memory to get anything that's stored there or store things there. And this would include both the machine code, the instructions the processor is actually running, and the actual data that those instructions might be operating on that doesn't fit in the registers. And our model was that the processor would communicate with the memory via this communication bus, we called it. And, well, we also needed some I.O. devices, so we'd use the same kind of interface for that and just tap on this component we called an I.O. bridge, which would direct some messages from the processor to these I.O. devices based on the addresses supplied by some sort of convention. Well, we mentioned this is a bit of a simplified model, and one of the ways in which it's simplified is that, well, caches mean that we don't actually always go to memory to get data. Sometimes we have some storage on the processor for data that's logically in memory, but we'll get to that later in the semester. And this model will be enough for the sort of processors we're going to deal with for around the first half of this course. Since we talked about memory being this array of bytes, we had this issue that, well, on a typical processor, we have instructions that manipulate things which aren't just single bytes, which manipulate integers of 4 or 8 bytes, and we have to decide how they map to those individual bytes. And there are these two logical choices, little and big endian, where we can just decide how do the bytes which have different indices in that array, which we called addresses, correspond to a bigger value. And little endian made the choice that the least significant part of the value, the bigger value, would be the part that's at the lowest address in the array of bytes, that's memory. Okay. After looking through how memory was organized, we started talking a bit about assembly, and we looked at AT&T syntax, which you probably saw very briefly in 2150, but it's not the main thing you use, but we're gonna use it because our textbook uses it and tools we'll use it. And the big things we learned about AT&T syntax is that we always have the destination last. We had this dollar sign before constants, and this percent sign before registers, and we had this special syntax for representing values in memory that an instruction would act on, where we have these four things we specify sort of as locations to fill in, a displacement, which is sort of this constant to add, a base register, an index register, which would be multiplied by a scale value, which would be a constant, which happens to have to be 1, 2, 4, 8. And I believe we briefly mentioned when we left off that you could omit different parts of this, of these, and it would still work. So there's basically, if you don't have a displacement, it defaults to 0. If you don't have a base register, we just assume you mean the value 0. If you don't have an index register, we assume you mean the value 0. If you don't have a scale, we assume you mean 1. So questions about these things we covered last time. Okay, not seeing any at least yet. So last time we also went over some logistics, and I promised I'd talk about quizzes. So we're going to have quizzes. The real quiz site is this site. You can see that we have, you can go through the quiz. I'm not going to open it because, well, it's not ready for you to see yet. because I might change it depending on what I cover in this lecture. So it opens after lecture and is due before the first lecture on Tuesday. And the way the quiz site works is when you go to a quiz, you'll get a, do you really want to view it? And of course I get locked out of NetBadge because I tested this demo for the AM lecture and not the PM one. And you'll see questions like this, so multiple choice. There also might be some short answer questions. Whenever you put in an answer, the box around the question should turn green when the answer is recorded. If it doesn't turn green, the answer is not recorded. If it does turn green, the answer is recorded. You can go away from the web page, come back later. The answer should still be there. We'll take the last answer you submit before the deadline, so you can close the quiz window, come back to it much later, and whatever you entered last will go. There's a place for comments. It stays yellow while you're typing, turns green when you move away. We will read those comments, which you probably should write something more coherent than that, because we'll actually read them. We're not just going to assume because you wrote a comment that you knew what you were doing. Comments are places for if you think a question's ambiguous, we're missing information, or we just made a mistake. You can write in the comments, and we will take that into account manually and adjust scores accordingly. Generally, I'm not going to be able to answer clarifying questions about the quiz. The main reason why is that, you know, if you ask the question on, you know, midday Friday, some people may have already taken the quiz and planned on doing other work on the rest of the day, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and Monday. And I don't want to send a message to the class that means that they have to go back, find time when they were planning on studying other things to potentially revise their answer. So generally, I'm going to deal with issues with how the quiz questions are written by adjusting them in grading, you know, accepting more answers, dropping them, etc. And if you think the question, there's some error in the question, use the comments field to explain what you think is going on. And if what you write down suggests that you know what's going on, even if it's not an interpretation we thought was reasonable, we'll probably give you some credit. So, and after the quiz is due, it will be, it will be automatically graded with a key. Comments will not be graded immediately because obviously we don't have someone just sitting there at 9:15 a.m. who's going to instant look through all your comments in a minute. That doesn't work that way. It's probably going to take a week. And when it's graded, you'll see the percentages of students who gave each answer and the key, which is here for multiple choice questions, marked with a T for the correct answers. And if you had a comment and it's been graded, there might be feedback about that comment, possibly with a grade adjustment, possibly not, depending on what the grader decided. And also, the quiz system, we will have some free response questions, which would look like this. Okay, questions? Yes. How long do you have for each quiz? You have from the time it's listed at its opening to the time it's listed as closing. Okay. And they are open book, open notes, no asking people for answers, but other than that, I guess it's just asking people for answers, and asking people obviously includes, like, don't copy the quiz question to something like Stack Overflow. Other questions? Yes. How many questions quizzes usually have? It's usually around 4. It might vary because not all questions are the same kind of amount of work. Yes. The comment section, so we probably won't read the comment if we think your answer is just correct. So the comment section is for if you think there is something that might have made that might make your answer not match the key. That explain things? Yeah.
It's completely individual, right? No collaboration.
No, yeah. Question quizzes are no collaboration. Yeah. They're individual. They are open book, open notes, but they're individual. Please don't work together, etc. Other questions? Okay. There we go. Okay. So I believe last time, I think we ended up, we went through this, and I think we ended up here, and we ended up, got to here, right. So we saw AT&T syntax for identifying memory locations. You have this sort of general three operand form, but you can omit all the parts. And very commonly you will, because you're not always doing something that looks like an array access with an offset, which is the most general form. And the only really confusing thing is that if you just have a number, it's a special case of this. It's an address. That's why we needed a dollar sign for constants, so we know we're not doing some version of this find a memory location thing. And we also mentioned that a consequence of the destination last, that's maybe not so obvious, is that our subtraction doesn't work in the order that you might have expected from Intel syntax, because it's the same instruction. It's a subtract from, and the same thing for comparing. The destination value is the value we worry about being greater or less than, and so on. And addresses, and I think, did we get to this last time? No, okay. So this is sort of our general form of AT&T syntax, destination last, value in memory, that general form where you can omit things, constants. So jumps deserve a little special note because there's this star. So jump star percent RAX says you look in RAX for the location where the code is, and then you go there. So the rationale behind having something like a star is that we aren't actually executing the machine code in RAX. We're using RAX to find the machine code. And related to that, this second example, we have a memory location, and that memory location is not where the machine code we want to execute is, it's where a pointer to that machine code is. So there's an extra indirection, that's what the star is indicating. So questions about these two jumps? Okay, and if you're asking why didn't they just use parentheses for the first one, I don't know. Okay, so that's everything we're going to care about for AT&T syntax. There's maybe a few other things that likely won't come up that are differences between Intel and AT&T, but this is going to be enough for us to work. So to review that, let's look at sort of an example, simple function written in assembly. So here's what the assembly code for a C function, which takes two pointers to longs and swaps the longs that they point to. This is what it might look like in AT&T syntax assembly. And remember that here the destination is last versus Intel syntax is the other way around. and we have a different syntax for memory location. So here's the equivalent in Intel syntax, if you remember Intel syntax still, or as some pseudocode. So we retrieve from RDI and RSI, which you may remember from 2150 are the locations of the first and second arguments in the calling convention. And then we write back to perform our swap and then return. And we can trace through how this function works. So initially, we're going to say we have some values in register, so we're passed two pointers to memory, who I have values for. And I'm writing memory here as a sequence of 8-byte values, even though it's really single-byte values, just for our convenience. We know it's really divided up into bytes, but we're not going to worry about that right now. And our first instruction here is move Q, so move 8 bytes, and the source, the first operand, is memory at the location specified by RDI. So to execute this instruction, we look at the register RDI and ask memory for the value at that memory location, which is, in this case, 4000. And here we get this all nines value, and we store that in RAX, the destination of this instruction. And similarly, our next instruction, we take RSI, access memory there, and store the result in RDX. Questions? Far? Yes.
What do the parentheses do?
So what do the parentheses do? So if we didn't have the parentheses, so if we had instead the instruction, say for the first one, I should go back here. So if we had just move Q RDI RAX, then we'd end up doing this operation instead of going through memory. And RAX, not REX. So we'd end up sending the value in RDI directly into REX. We wouldn't access memory at all. Other questions? Yes. So the question is, long equivalent to a quad? So on the C compilers we're used to, a long is an 8-byte value, and Q is for 8 bytes, because quad means 4 times 2 bytes. So they're the same size, yes.
It would be 4 if it was like an int, regularly.
It would be, sorry?
It would be like 4, or?
So an int on the systems we're used to would be 4 bytes, which would be move L. And also, instead of using RAX, we use EAX, and so on. Yes?
I'm a bit confused. So, like, are you saying that without the parentheses, it would just create a pointer from RDI to RAX?
Without the parentheses, it would move the value in RDI, which is, in this example, 4000, into RAX. So RAX would become 4000. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay. So then we get to the instructions which go in the other direction. So here we have an instruction that takes RDI and accesses memory there to store, because RDI is part of the destination address computation. And what are we storing? Well, we're storing the source, which is RDX, which is this 7777 value from earlier. And similarly, our second instruction uses RSI, ends up writing the all nines value to 4030, which it got from reading RSI's address. The address stored in RSI, I should say. Yes?
Just to make sure, if it didn't have parentheses, then it would have moved to the register itself.
Yeah, so the question is, if there wasn't parentheses, what would have happened? If there wasn't parentheses, this all nines value would be the new value of RSI. Other questions? Okay. So finally, we have a return instruction. And I haven't written on this slide, what registers does the return instruction deal with? So people are saying RAX, any other registers the return instruction deals with? An RSP. Okay, so RAX is not a register the return instruction deals with. There's a reason everyone seems to think it that way, and that's because you say, oh, RAX is where the return value is. So the question is, how does the return value get to the caller of a function? So in this example, this function doesn't really have a return value. If it did, it would be an RAX. And let's say we wanted to use RAX after this function returned. Well, the return instruction doesn't need to do anything to let us use the last value of RAX. It's going to be there if the return instruction does nothing to RAX. And that's, in fact, what it does. It doesn't change RAX. That's why you can use it for the return address. We've just chosen that of the many registers the return instruction doesn't change, we'll use RAX for that purpose, just by convention. So it doesn't change RAX. It does change RSP. Someone remember why? Yes? The stack pointer. So what about the stack pointer? Why does it need to change? Yeah? So it goes, you say, back on the stack to where the method was actually called. So why is where the method's called on the stack? What happened? You have a follow-up, or you want me to go to someone else? Okay, behind you.
So when you call a function, the return address gets pushed onto the stack. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so the call instruction pushed a return address, that is the machine code we want to go back to, the address of the machine code, onto the stack. So the return instruction is going to pop that. To pop something from the stack, you need to change the stack pointer to make it so that value you popped is no longer on the stack. So that's why it's going to change the stack pointer. But all the return instruction is doing is going back to that old location. It doesn't need to deal with the return value. The return value is correct because code before the return instruction said it, and nothing changed it. So other follow-up questions? Yes?
Return also, is return a fundamental thing, or does it actually just call jump? And if it doesn't just call jump, does it also change the return instruction?
So the question is, return a fundamental thing, or does it just call jump? So at the level we're going to speak of instructions, there's not really a notion of an instruction calling another instruction. So it's fundamental in that sense. It's, you know, at the same level as jump as far as we're concerned. You could imagine implementations, and probably in most processors, like return and jump share some logic in their implementation. Question, can I explain how RAX is not affected by the return? So if this function was returning a value, we would set RAX deliberately to the return value before the return instruction. And then if after this function returned, we wanted to do something with the return address, we'd read from RAX. And so if we just replaced the return with a jump that clearly doesn't change RAX, that would be correct as far as the return value goes. And for that reason, there's no reason for the return instruction to do anything with the return value. It just needs to not touch it. And since there's no reason to, we don't bother. Other questions? Okay. So something which came up earlier is someone asked, oh, this function I showed you here, I have longs, what if we had ints? And we mentioned, as you probably vaguely remember from 2050, that we have registers other than RAX, like EAX. And EAX is just a name for part of the RAX register. So RAX is like the real register, but we have names for these pieces of it. So we have EAX, which is a name for the least significant 32 bits. We have AX, which is a name for the least significant 16 bits. AL is a name for the least significant 8 bits. And AH is a name for the most significant 8 bits of the least significant 16 bits. And There are similar names for a lot of parts of the other registers, and I have this sort of all in this diagram. So we have names for parts of REP, RSI, and RSP, and RDI, which follow this pattern, and names for R9, R8 through R15, which follow this pattern. And it would seem for the most part that, you know, these smaller pseudo registers are just names for part of the register. And that would be the most logical thing to assume. There is a special case I'm going to mention, because when you do the BOM assignment and you look at the code the compiler generated, there's something about how it uses these overlapping registers which is a little non-intuitive because of a special rule that x86-64 has. So in 64-bit x86, when you set a 32-bit register, it clears the upper 32 bits of the most significant 32 bits of the corresponding 64-bit register. Sets them all to zeros. And this is just a rule that anytime you set the 32-bit registers, it also sets the upper bits of the corresponding 64-bit register. When AMD's designers were going from 32 to 64 bits, they said, yeah, it would be useful to have this automatic behavior of automatically clearing the top of the 64-bit registers. And when you look at the code compilers generate, they'll take a lot of advantage of this. So when they want to set a 64-bit value to zero, often they'll set EAX to zero and then use RAX. And this is guaranteed to work because of this special rule. So in this example here, for example, if I set RAX to all ones and then store one in EAX, EAX is one, not all ones in the top, in the most significant 32 bits, and then one in the bottom 32 bits, like you'd expect with the most natural interpretation of this diagram I just showed you here. Yes? The question is it more efficient to set EAX than RAX? It uses shorter machine code, which is probably why the compiler doesn't. Question over here? And so the question is, are there practical use cases? I think the reason for the design, beyond that it maybe gives shorter ways of setting the 64-bit registers, is just that usually when you set the 32-bit register, you stop caring about the remainder of the 64-bit register. So you might as well have the processor enforce that for you. Yes? So the question is, what happens when you set one of the 8 or 16-bit subsets? And the answer is, they do the more natural thing and only set that part of the register. And basically what happened is that the transition from 8 to 16 to 32-bit happened at a different time than the transition from 32 to 64-bit, so different design decisions were made at the two different times. Other questions? So in this example, with the 8-bit register, it in fact only sets those 8 bits. It doesn't clear the rest of it. And the same would be true with the 16-bit pieces. OK. So that's on these overlapping registers. So another thing you saw in 2150 that we probably should try to get a better understanding of are labels. So labels are sort of names you use in assembly. Like when you say call foo, you know, foo is a label. When you have like a string in your assembly code that you reference, you're typically naming that string with a label so you can get its address in other instructions. And labels represent addresses. So the label is basically find and replaced for the address of the thing the label, you know, it marks. So to give an example here, we've defined the label string to be the location of this A string data. We could have also defined it to be the location of some instruction, some machine code, but in this case, I chose to put a string with that, the name string marking the beginning of that string. And when we use the label just as a bare word, what's that, that's going to do is that's going to be as if we used the actual memory location of this string. So if this string ends up being stored at, say, address 0x12345, then this here, this first add queue, is like we wrote add queue 0x12345RAX. And if we remember how writing a bare number in AT&T syntax assembly works, that means we're accessing memory at that address. So this first instruction reads the string as if it were an 8-byte number and adds it to RAX, which almost certainly would not be what you wanted to do, but it's a valid instruction, it's a real computation the processor can do for you. The second version is going to add the address of the string, because we have this dollar sign to represent a constant. So if it was at 12345, it's going to add 12345 to RAX. And this might be something you do if you wanted to compute the address of like a particular character of the string. So if RAX started at 1, you compute the address of the second character, the one with index 1, where indexes start at 0. So questions on what happens here? How these labels work. Where were they?
So for the first instruction, it treats the label as an address and finds the value in that address?
The question is, for the first instruction treats the label as an address and finds the value at that address? Yes. And that's just because if we just wrote a number and an add instruction without any dollar sign, it's an address. Okay. Question back there? So the first instruction is presuming you already set string as a label in some previous instruction. So the way we make sure string as a label exists is by defining it like we do here with string colon, which could be later in the file, like in this example.
Okay.
Other questions back there?
So labels are essentially pointers?
Yes, they're because pointers are addresses of something. And that's precisely what a label, you know, is represents. Other questions? Yeah. So a question, is there like assumed parentheses in labels? Because you're saying, why does this access memory? So if you remember when I went over our forms of AT&T syntax addressing, when we omit all the registers, we end up with no parentheses. And what you're seeing there is just a case of that. So it's not that there's implicit parentheses, it's that no parentheses means we access memory in AT&T syntax, unless we have some other indicator that we don't. Other questions? Labels, which are definitely a common point of confusion. And there's also another thing that definitely, well, probably didn't come up in 2150. I'm going to go over. So there's another, what looks like a register called RIP, which stands for the instruction pointer, IP, which you also might know as the program counter. So it's equal to the address of that instruction, but you can't actually like move into it. But you'll commonly see it used, especially by compilers, to, for example, move a value that's some amount after the current instruction somewhere. And the reason the compiler would like to do this is this means that the compiler can generate code that is, you know, has its data with it, such that you can just move that code and data anywhere in memory and not have to worry about substituting to have it be in a particular place in the executable. So compilers like generating code using this sort of instruction. And in assembly, to help the compiler out, there's this very special case which is not intuitive. If you write assembly that does label %RIP, with parentheses around the RIP, you'd think that that would turn into label plus the address of the current instruction. So if the label's at address 0x12345, the current instruction's at address 5000, you think it would be 64325. That's not what it does. Instead, the assembler computes the actual offset to make it behave the same as label, but use different machine code to compute the address. And I'm just mentioning this not because we're going to test you on it, but because if you look at assembly in the BOM lab or homework, or just look at how a compiler generates assembly, you might come across this, and I just want you to know what's going on, why doesn't that make sense? It's just an exception that they made for to make it more convenient for the compiler to write instructions like the one you see on top. Okay. So questions about the instruction pointer register? Okay, so let's do a little exercise here. So I have some assembly code where we have a string, which we have a label, which is going to be the address of the string, which is, of course, the address of the first character. This is going to be a null terminated string, so there's a zero character at the end. And we have some assembly code that does something related to the string, then calls puts. And puts is a C library function that's prints out its argument, or expects its argument to be a null terminated string. So you can think of it as kind of like the C standard library's equivalent of C out of a string. And the question here is, what is actually passed to puts? What is puts's argument? I'll give you a minute or two. You can talk with your neighbors. How do we end up calling puts with this assembly code? Okay, who'd like some more time? More time? Guess. Okay, so who thinks A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, no clue? Okay. Okay, so let's go over what's happening here. Looks like we have a big split with no one really dominant answer. So I made an explanation slide for this between the since the first lecture. So we have our string hello world, and it's stored as individual characters. Each character has its own memory location because it's one byte in ASCII. And the label hello is the address of the H. Hello plus one is the address of the E. If the string is stored at address 123456, then hello is as if we wrote 123456 in the assembly code, and hello plus one is as if we wrote 123457. And if we remember what we went over before this about how specifying a number in AT&T syntax, what is that reference? Well, if we don't have a dollar sign, it's a memory address. So this accesses memory at this address, and this is move B, so B is one byte. So we get one byte from that address. What's the one byte at this address? It's the ASCII for E. So the ASCII for E goes into BL, 8-bit register, and then we run a subtract instruction. Sub B means subtract with byte size values. So we subtract one from the ASCII for E, and it turns out if you look at your ASCII table, the character just before E in ASCII is the character for D. So that means that BL is now the ASCII for D. And then we move from BL to somewhere that ASCII for D, and we move it to hello, not hello plus one. And hello is the address of the H, and we're moving it to memory because we don't have a dollar sign, and we're using a label. So we're moving it to that memory location. We're moving one byte because it's a move B, so you don't have to worry about any of the other characters changing. So we're going to replace this H with a D. So now our string is Dello world instead of hello world. And well, we still have to figure out how are we actually calling put S. So we have this final move, which is move Q, so move 8 bytes. And the 8 bytes we're moving is this dollar sign hello. And dollar sign means it's a constant. So it's the number that's hello represents, which is that address 123456. That's what's going to be an RDI. That number is an address. So we're giving it the address of the character now D, the beginning of the string, which is the same as a pointer to the string. So the correct answer back here was B. Questions? Yes. Question is, why aren't we using parentheses around BL to access its value? So we don't need parentheses to access a value in a register. When we put parentheses around a register, we're saying that the register contains a value that's not the one we want to access. Instead, the value in the register tells us where in memory the value we want to access is. And that's not the case here. And that should never be the case because BL is only 8 bits. That's not big enough for an address. Way back there. So the question is, what would happen if it was move B dollar sign hello plus one BL? Is that what you're asking? So that's going to take the number hello plus one, which is the address. So in our example, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 5, 7, and add it to BL. Now that address is probably bigger than 8 bits. So either the assembler or something is going to complain, say, wait a moment, that constant's too big, what are you doing? Or it's going to truncate it and add it and truncate the value. Other questions? Yeah. What questions, where's the call queue puts? So this is the same as call puts. The queue just represents the size of values call is dealing with, which is 8 bytes, because that's the size of our addresses. And as you may or may not remember from 2150, the call instruction is kind of like jump, except before jumping, it pushes onto the stack the address of the following instruction, which in this case is the return instruction. So when puts returns, it will jump to our return instruction from its return instruction, and then we'll return and jump to whoever called this example function. That answer your question? This question is, what does puts do? So puts is a C standard library function that prints out a string to the terminal. Back there? Puts is kind of just print?
Yeah,
puts is the simplest print function in the C standard library. Yes? Question is, the value that hello is storing is a string's address. I would say the value that hello will be replaced with is a string's address, yes. I wouldn't say it's storing it, because like you can't like change where the label is after you make the executable. It's fixed. So it's kind of like a constant that the assembler will fill in with wherever it puts that string. Does that answer your question? Okay, back there. So the question is, does puts always use RDI, or could it use other registers? So if you remember your calling convention from 2150, so if this is a 64-bit x86 system which uses the Linux calling convention, the rule is that the first argument to puts is an RDI, so that's where it's going to look. And if it looked anywhere else, that would be a function which had a different prototype. That answer your question? Other questions? Yeah.
Could the first three lines be accomplished in a single line?
So the question is, could the first three lines be accomplished in a single line? Not in a way that I'm aware of, because you have to read from one location and write to a different one.
Okay. Can it be done in two, though?
Can it be done in two is the question. Not in a way I'm aware of. Other questions? Yes. Question is, if instead of move B we had move Q and we changed BL to an 8-byte register, would that take 8 characters? Yes. So it would take 8 characters, put them in the register as if they were combined into an integer. And subtract would subtract from it, which in little endian ends up usually only modifying the first character. And then if the second move b was a move q, we would write over 8 characters. Okay, that answer your question. Other questions? Okay. Okay. So that's looking at what we've seen so far about how labels work and how we identify things that are and aren't accessing memory. So related to accessing memory, There's an instruction you probably saw in 2150 that's a constant source of confusion, so we're going to spend some time talking about it, which is LEA, which stands for Load Effective Address. So effective address is just a name for the address that an instruction will access memory at. And LEAs look like move instructions, but they skip the memory access. So they just find an address, but rather than actually using that address, they just store that address in their destination. So sort of the logical use case is that, you know, you want to use the syntax for writing addresses to compute an address, but you don't want to access it right away. You just want to put a pointer to it somewhere for to use later. The LEA instruction gives you that. So you can use the base index scale syntax to compute like the address as part of an array, put it in a register to use as a pointer later. But because the LEA instruction doesn't access memory, it doesn't actually care if it's a valid address. It's just computing as if it were an address. So in this example here, this LEA of 4 plus RAX is almost the same. We'll learn next time the very subtle way in which it's different. But it's almost the same as adding 4 to RAX, because that syntax for 4 parentheses RAX says access memory at the address computed by adding 4 to RAX. But LEA just computes the address at which we would access memory, doesn't actually bother with accessing memory, and just shoves that address in its destination register, which in this case is RAX. So you can kind of think of LEA, which may or may not help you, as kind of like the address of operator in C++ or C. So we have something which specifies an address, and we get its address of that expression and store it somewhere. So questions about what LEA is? So LEA probably makes the most sense when you think of, oh, this is a way in which I can compute the address of something and store it somewhere to use later, so I don't have to recompute it every time. Or if I want to compute it in multiple steps. But the LEA instruction is really just doing the arithmetic that the processor supports for computing addresses. And it turns out that that sort of arithmetic is useful for things that aren't computing addresses. And since the processor needs to compute those addresses fast, it has some very good circuitry for that. So we might as well make it available to compilers for normal arithmetic. And they, in fact, use LEA to do that. So in addition to seeing LEA used to get a pointer to part of an array, if that's what your C code is doing, you might see it used to do arithmetic. So for example, if you tell a compiler to multiply an integer times 5, it could use this LEA instruction to do it, which might be faster than using a multiply. And you might say, wait a moment, but if RAX is 5, 5 is not a valid memory location, and nor is 25. So isn't that going to crash? No, because LEA doesn't actually access memory. It's just manipulating the numbers that there are addresses, or could be addresses, I should say. It doesn't care if they're real addresses. It's going to do the same computation, and the compiler takes advantage of that. The second example here, this LEA here does an add of RBX and RCX into RDX. And why would that be useful? Well, if you think of doing this with an add instruction, we'd actually need two instructions, because we need to do a move first to avoid overwriting RBX or RCX and doing the same computation. So because of this, when you're looking at code compilers generated, you'll see LEA, even though it's effective address, used for things that aren't addresses. They're just doing the address math, but on things that aren't addresses. And the processor doesn't care, because the address math is just math as far as it's concerned, until you tell it to actually do something with memory. Only then will you run into trouble if it's not a real address. So questions about these ways of using LEA? Yes? So can I explain the not accessing the memory part? Sure. So if this were a move instruction, with the same operands, we would compute RAX times 5 and access memory there. So this would set RAX to memory at RAX times 5. Like, we load from the array of memory bytes at that location into RAX. Or if this were, say, the same thing, but with an add, so if this were add queue and the same thing, we would set RAX to RAX plus memory, plus the value we read from memory at that location. So normally, when you see that first operand, that means the instruction is going to actually go to memory and do something with the value there. In the case of LEA, that's not true. It doesn't go to memory. It just takes where it would have gone to memory and uses that as the answer. Does that explain things okay? Follow-ups? Over there? So I'm saying if we had add queue with the same operand, so if you add queue RAX comma RAX 4 RAX, then the last operand, the destination, is RAX. So we're going to write into RAX, and we're going to add RAX and that first operand, which is a location in memory, together. Does that make sense? Okay. Other questions? Yes. So the question is, why is the LEA circuitry, why would it have better circuitry? So I guess I should say, I'm saying typically a processor would have fast circuitry for these computations, but it's not required, right? You can implement the instruction set and have something randomly be slow. The reason why a processor is likely to have fast circuitry for these sorts of address computations is because they happen all the time, right? Almost every instruction could have this sort of address computation, so you want to have a lot of circuitry that can do that efficiently just to execute normal programs. As for why like normal instructions like multiply wouldn't do that, well, multiplies do have pretty fast circuitry, but this sort of computation is less general, right? We can't multiply by anything with this because our scale value can only be 1, 2, 4, or 8. And so, you know, if you compare it to a multiply instruction, which needs to handle multiplying by anything, it makes some sense that it might be faster, just because the multiply instruction needs to do something a lot more general. Other questions? Okay, so since we've seen LEA, let's do another exercise. So here's a function. This is code that a compiler might generate for something. So I should explain the first part, because there's something a bit confusing here. This is LEAL. So this is LEA with a 4-byte destination register. And you might say, wait a moment, addresses are 8 bytes. Isn't that wrong? And this is allowed. So what's going to happen is we're going to compute an 8-byte address and only use the least significant 4 bytes of it. And since we're writing to EAX, and we had that special rule about writing to 32-bit registers, we're going to clear the upper bits of RAX when we write to it. Now you might say, okay, it's a 32-bit LEA instruction. Why do we have RDI and not EDI? Why isn't that an error? And in fact, you have to have RDI. You can't put EDI there. And the reason for that is that, well, addresses are still 8-byte computations, and that doesn't change. So we have to use 8 bytes for the thing we're computing as if it were an address. Even though it's not really an address here, and that's really clear because we're chopping off the top 4 bytes of it. And we probably shouldn't do that to an address we expect to work. And so, and the other thing to remind you is that Remember at the beginning I reviewed destinations are last for subtract instructions. That's going to come up here. So with that in mind, give you a minute or two or three, check with your neighbors, what is this function? Like, what code could I have written that the compiler would have generated this for? Question? The question is, why is there a leading comma? So that's the same as if it wasn't there. It's just saying that there's no base register. Okay. So this is... Thank you. Okay, let's see. Who would like some more time? Okay, so who thinks A? Okay, no A, no A's. Okay. B. C. U. D. E. Majority F. Okay, so E is the right answer, and it's very close to D, but not quite D. So let's go over what goes on here. So we start out, we have this instruction sets EIX to RDI times 8, which is truncated, which is going to be arg times 8. So arg is RDI. Now, some of you might have some complaints. You remember calling convention well, and you'll say, well, arg is an int on the sort of systems we deal with. Ints are 4 bytes. That would go in EDI, not RDI. So why is it OK to use RDI here? So there's a couple explanations I can give. So one is that if you remember our rule that when you set a 32-bit register, it sets the rest of the 64-bit register, this means that if whoever called us set EDI, they also set RDI to the same value. Well, at least with leading zeros. And when we multiply by 8, we're not going to notice those upper bits because we're going to get rid of them with the rest of this LEA instruction. So that's one argument for there's nothing, no problem here with using RDI versus EDI. One reason is because we know the upper bits of RDI are all zeros, so we can kind of know exactly what's going to happen that way. But more importantly, we're not using those upper bits after the multiply, so they're not going to affect the answer we put in EDI or EAX here. Question? So the question is, could I put EDI inside there? If you try to do that, the assembler is going to say, you can't do that. And the reason why is that because LEA is an address computation instruction, even though we're not really computing an address here, it expects something that could be an address, and addresses are always 8 bytes. Okay, back there. So the question is, could I run into a problem if the upper bytes of RDI weren't cleared? And the answer is that for this multiply operation, no, because any overflow or something like that happens is only going to affect those upper bytes. And so it won't matter what they are. So them being zero actually isn't necessary for this to work, but it sure makes it easier to figure out for sure that it does work. Yes. So question is, what is this leading comma here? This leading comma right here. And this is the same as if I didn't write it. So write that comma at all. So if I go back to our simplifications of the syntax, so writing the comma there is being explicit that I omitted the base register. We could have also omitted it. And it's the same thing. Any question there?
Yeah. So basically, what happens is what you call the argument from R of an int, which is 4 bytes, so the upper part was never used, right? Is that what you're
Question is, because the arg was an int, the upper part was ever, never used of the RDI register? Yes. Other questions? Okay, so the first part, we set EAX to arg times 8, and then we set EAX with this subtract instruction. We subtract from, remember that unomic I gave earlier, so EAX becomes EAX minus EDI. So EDI is arg, and EAX from the LEA instruction is arg times 8. So this is arg times 8 minus arg, which is arg times 7. But it's not negated. And that's where I'll finish up today. Remember, there's a quiz due on Tuesday.